Chapter 17. The second course will probably seem less acceptable to many readers, but all who are qualified to speak will testify to its enormous educational value. It is what one may speak of as the biological course. Just as the conception of energy will be the central idea of the natural philosophy course, so the conception of organic evolution will be the central idea of the biological course. A general review of the whole field of biology, not only of the natural history of the present, but of the geological record in relation to the known laws, and the various main theories of the evolutionary process will be taken, and in addition some special department, either the comparative anatomy of the vertebrata chiefly, or of the plants chiefly, or of several invertebrated groups chiefly, will be exhaustively worked out in relation to these speculations. The first of these alternatives is not only probably the most invigorating mental exercise of the three, but bears also more directly upon the practical concerns of life. Physiology will be taken up in relation to this special exhaustive study, and the elementary physics of the schooling stage will be prolonged up into a treatment of chemistry with a special reference to biological problems. Through such a course as this, students might pass to the study of medicine just as well as through natural philosophy, and the medical profession would profit by the clash of the two types of student. The biological course, with its insistence upon heredity and physiological facts, would also give the very best and gravest preparation in the world for the practical concerns of motherhood. From its students would pass on illuminated to the study of psychology, philosophical science, and educational method. The training in the discussion of broad generalization, and much of the fact involved, would be a most excellent preliminary to special theological study, and also to the advanced study of economics and political science. From this course also artists of various sorts would escape through the avenue of section I, which, by the by, would have to involve historical reading. So much for my second suggested college course. The third of these three alternative courses is the history course, done extensively in relation to general geography, economic theory, and the general evolution of the world, and intensively in relation to British or American history, and perhaps to some particular period. Out of it would spring a thorough study of the development of English literature, and also of the legal systems of the English-speaking peoples. This course also would be a way of approach to philosophical science, to theology, to the thorough study of economic and political science, and possibly it would contribute a larger proportion of its students to imaginative literature than either of the two preceding courses. It would also be the natural preliminary course to the special study of law, and so a source of politicians. In the section I of this course, a light, but lucid treatment of the great generalizations of physical and biological science would be desirable. And from this course also the artist would break away. Conceivably there are other courses. The course in mathematics as one sees it given to the Cambridge Tripos men, and what is called the classical course, will occur to the reader. Few people, however, are to be found who will defend the exclusively mathematical rind as a sound intellectual training, and so it need not be discussed here. The case, however, is different with the classical course. It is alleged by those who have had the experience that to learn Latin and Greek more or less thoroughly, and then to stumble through one or two Latin and Greek authors and the original has an educational value surpassing any conceivable alternative. There is a mysterious benefit from one's private translation, however bad, that no other translation, however good, can impart. Plato, for example, who has certainly in the very best translations, quite perceptibly no greater mind than Lord Bacon, Newton, Darwin, or Adam Smith, becomes godlike to all who pass beyond the little go. The controversy is as old as the Battle of the Books, a quite interminable wrangle, which I will not even attempt to summarize here. For my own part, I believe all this defense of the classics on the part of men with classical education is but one more example of that human weakness that splashes Oxford metaphysical writings with needless tags and shreds of Greek and set Demetrius the silversmith bawling in the streets. If the reader is of another opinion, there is no need to convert him in this present argument, provided only that he will admit the uselessness of his high mystery for the training of the larger mass of modern men. By his standards, they are beneath it. A convention upon this issue between the two parties, therefore, is attainable. Let us admit the classical course for the parents who like and can afford this sort of thing for their sons and daughters. Let us withdraw all objections to its endowment, unless it is quite excessive endowment. Let the classical be the senior service, and the classical professor, to use his own queer way of putting things, primus inter pares. That will make four courses altogether, the classical, the historical, the biological, and the physical, for one or more of which all the secondary schools and colleges in that great English-speaking community at which the new republic aims should be organized. Footnote. One may, however, suggest one other course as possible under special conditions. There is one sort of art that requires not only a very rigorous and exhaustive training, but also an early commencement, and that is music, at once the most isolated and the most universal of arts. Exceptional gifts in the direction of music will have appeared in the schooling stage, and it is quite conceivable that the college phase for those who are destined for a musical career should have as its backbone a grind in the theory and practice of music, with languages and general culture relegated to a section I. It may be objected that this is an idealized proposal, and that existing conditions, which are, of course, the material out of which new conditions are to be made, do not present anything like this form. As a matter of fact, if only the reader will allow for a certain difference in terminology, they do. What I have here called schooling is, so far as the age of the pupils go, typically presented in Great Britain by what is called the elementary school, and in America by the public school, and certain schools that unanalytical people in England, mistaking a social for an educational difference, seem disposed to class with secondary schools, the inferior grammar schools, the cheaper private schools, and what are called preparatory schools. Footnote. As things are, there is no doubt a considerable advantage in the child from a good home going on to a good preparatory school instead of entering a public elementary school, and the passage above must not be misread as a sweeping condemnation of such establishments. Are really also elementary schools. The latter have more social pretension, and sometimes far less efficiency than a government elementary school, but that is all the difference. All these schools admit of a gradual approximation to the ideal of schooling already set forth in the sixth of these papers. Some are already within a measurable distance of that ideal. And above these elementary schools, above the school grade proper, and answering to what is here called college, there is a great variety of day and evening schools of the most varied description, which agree all of them in the presentation of a second phase in the educational process beginning about the age of 13 to 16 and going on to 19 and 20. In Great Britain, such institutions are sometimes called secondary schools and sometimes colleges, and they have no distinct boundary line to separate them from the university proper, on the one hand, or the organized science schools and the higher grade board schools and evening classes of the poorer sort. The universities and medical schools are, indeed, hampered with work quite similar to that of secondary schools, and which the secondary schools have failed to do: the Cambridge undergraduate before his little go, the London University medical student before his preliminary scientific examination, are simply doing the belated work of this second stage. And there is, I doubt not, a similar vague complexity in America. But through the fog, something very like the boundary line here placed about 14 is again and again made out, Not only the general requirements for efficient education, but the trend of present tendency seems to be towards a scheme of three stages in which a first stage of 9 or 10 years of increasingly serious schooling, primary education, from a very light beginning about 5 up to about 14, is to be followed by a second stage of college education, secondary education, from 14 or 16 to an upward boundary determined by class and various facilities, and this is to be succeeded by a third stage, which we will now proceed to consider in detail. Let us make it clear at once that this third stage is a much ampler thing than the graduation or post-graduation work of a university. It may or it may not include that as an ingredient. But the intention is to express all those agencies other than political, social, and economic forces, and the suggestions that arise from them, that go to increase and build up the mental structure of the man or woman. This includes the pulpit, so far as it is still a vehicle for the importation of ideas and emotions, the stage, books that do anything more than pass the time, newspapers, the Grove and the Agora. These all, in greater or lesser degrees, work powerfully together to make the citizen. They work most powerfully, of course, in those plastic unsettled years that last from adolescence to the middle 20s, but often in very slowly diminishing intensity right into the closing decades of middle age. However things may have been in the quieter past, when newspapers did not exist, when creeds were rigid, plays mere spectacles to be seen only in town, and books rare, the fact remains that today everybody goes much further, and learns far more than any of the professedly educational agencies can be held accountable for. There was a time, perhaps, when a man really did settle down intellectually, at the end of his days of learning, when the only way outside the libraries and households of a few princely personages to go on thinking and to participate in the secular development of ideas was to go to a university and hear and dispute. But those days have gone for 100 years at least. They have gone by, and the strange thing is that a very large proportion of those who write and talk about education have not discovered they have gone by, and still think and talk of universities as though they were the only sources and repositories of wisdom. They conjure up a vision in my mind of an absent-minded water seller, bearing his precious jars and crying his wares knee-deep, and going deeper into a rising stream. Or if that does not seem just to the university in the past, an image of a gardener, who long ago developed a novel variety of some great flower which has now scattered its wind-borne seed everywhere, but who still proffers you for sale in a confidential, condescending manner a very little, very dear packet of that universal commodity. Until the advent of Mr. Ewart with his Public Libraries Act, Mr. Passmore Edwards, and Mr. Andrew Carnegie, the stream of endowment for research and teaching flowed just as exclusively to the universities as it did in Tudor times. Let us deal, then, first with the finally less important and more formal portion of the third stage in the educational process, that is to say, with the university course. One may conceive that, so far as positive teaching and learning go, a considerable proportion of the population will never pass beyond the second stage at all. They will fail to keep up in the course of that stage, or they will branch off into the special development of some special aptitude. The failures will gravitate into positions a little better perhaps, but analogous to those taken up by the failures of the schooling phase. The common clerks and common shop hands, for example, would come out here. The others, who fall out without completing their college course, but who may not be college failures at all, will be all sorts of artists and specializing persons of that type. A great many girls, for economic and other reasons, will probably never get beyond the college stage. They will pass from the biological and historical courses into employment, or marry, or enter domestic life. But what may finally become a much larger proportion of new Republican citizens will either from the beginning, taken the college course in the evening, or after a year or so of full attendance at the college course, start also upon the third grade work, the preparation for the upper ranks of some technical and commercial employment, for the systematic and liberal instruction that will replace the old rule of thumb apprenticeship. One can imagine a great variety of methods of combining the apprenticeship phase of serious occupation with the college course. Many waking up to the demands of life may do better for themselves with a desperately clutched college course of evening classes than others who will have progressed comfortably in day colleges. There should be opportunity by means of scholarship openings for such cases of a late awakening to struggle back into the higher education. There may be every gradation from such students to those who will go completely and exhaustively through the college, and who will then go on at 1 and 20 or 2 and 20 to equally complete and exhaustive work in the third grade. One imagines the third grade in its completeness as a most varied choice of thorough studies carried on for 3 or 4 years after 18 or 21, special schools of medicine, law, engineering, psychology, and educational science, economics and political science, economics and commercial science, philosophy, and theology, and physical science. Quite apart from the obvious personal limitation, the discussion of the method of dealing specifically with each of these subjects would be too diversified and special a theme to occupy me now. The larger fact to which attention has to be given is this, that all these studies and all the technical study and such like preparation at lower levels of the third stage must be as it were floating in a common body of thought, which is the unifying principle, the common initiative, the real common life of the truly civilized state, and that this body of thought is no longer to be contained within the form of a university. It is the larger of the two things. And the last question, therefore, in these speculations is the general organization of that body of thought, that is to say of contemporary literature, using the word in its widest sense, to cover all that is good in journalism, all untechnical speculative philosophical writing, all that is true and new in the drama, in poetry, fiction or any other distinctly literary form, and all scientific publication that is not purely a matter of recording or technical working out, all scientific publication that is, that deals with general ideas. There was a time when the higher education was conceived of as entirely a matter of learning. To endow chairs and teachers, and to enable promising scholars to come and hear the latter was the complete organization of the higher education. It is within quite recent years that the conception of endowing research for its own sake, leaving the research professor free altogether from direct teaching, or with only a few good pupils whose work consisted chiefly in assimilating his ideas and helping with his researches, has become at all widely acceptable. Indirectly, of course, the research professor is just as much a teacher as the teaching professor, because his results become accessible as he writes them. Our work now is to broaden both the conception of research and of teaching, to recognize that whatever imports fresh and valid ideas, fresh and valid aspects not simply of chemical and physical matters, but of aesthetic, social, and political matters, partakes of the honor and claims of research, and that whatever conveys ideas and aspects vividly and clearly and invigoratingly, not simply by word of mouth, but by book or picture or article, is teaching. The publication of books, the whole business of bringing the contemporary book most efficiently home to the general reader, the business of contemporary criticism, the encouragement and support of contemporary writers, is just as vitally important in the modern state as the organization of colleges and schools, and just as little to be left to the enterprise of isolated individuals working primarily upon commercial lines for gain. There are two aspects of this question. There is the simpler one of getting an abundance of good books, classical and contemporary, and of good publications distributed everywhere through the English-speaking world, and there is the more subtle and complex problem of getting, stimulating, and sustaining the original writers and the original critics and investigators upon whom the general development of contemporary thought, upon whom indeed the progress of the world finally depends. The latter problem may be reserved for the next paper, and here we will deal simply with the question of access and distribution. For the present, we must assume the quality of the books. All that sort of question must be deferred for our final discussion. We will simply speak of good books, serious books, on the one hand, and of light and merely amusing books on the other, in an intentionally vague way. The former sort of books is our present concern. Pleasure as an end, pleasure except as necessary recuperation, is no affair for the state. Books are either bought or borrowed for reading, and we have to consider what can be done to secure the utmost efficiency in the announcement, lending, and selling of books. We have also to consider the best possible means of distributing periodicals. We have particularly to consider how books specifically ood, coro, irius, and periodicals that are owned and timulating are to be made as widely and invitingly accessible as possible. The machinery we have in hand are the booksellers and the newsvendors, the circulating libraries, the post office, and the free public libraries that are now being energetically spread throughout the land by men who, in this aspect, answer very closely to the conception of New Republicans as it is here unfolded, and to bring and keep all this machinery to the very highest level of efficiency is integral to the New Republican scheme of activity. It may be objected that the organization of bookselling and publishing is the discussion of trivial details in the intellectual life of a people, but indeed that is not so. It is a constant trouble, a perpetual drain upon the time and energy of every man who participates in that life, to get the books that are necessary to the development of his thoughts. The high price of books, burthensome as it is the lesser evil. The great trouble is the trouble of access. There are a great number of people now who read nothing at all, or only promiscuous fiction, who would certainly become real readers were books of any other sort attractively available. These things are not trivial. The question of book distribution is as vitally important to the intellectual health of a modern people as are open windows in cases of phthisis. No nation can live under modern conditions unless its whole population is mentally aerated with books. That allusion to the predominance of fiction brings one round to the question of the public library. One is constantly reading attacks on these new and most promising institutions, and always these attacks base themselves on the fact that the number of novels taken out was so many times, so many hundred times greater than the number of erroneous books. Follows nonsense about crappy reading, shallowness of the public mind, and so forth. In Great Britain, public pomposities take up the strain and deliver large, vague, foolish discourses on our intellectual decline. It occurs to none of these people, nothing, indeed, ever does seem to occur to this sort of people to inquire if a man or woman can get serious reading from a public library. An inspection of a public library catalogue reveals, no doubt, a certain proportion of erroneous books available, but, as a rule, that erroneous site is a quite higgledy-piggledy heap of fragments. Suppose, for example, an intelligent mechanic has a proclivity for economic questions, he will find no book, whatever, to guide him to what literature there may be upon those questions. He will plunge into the catalogue, and discover perhaps a few publications of the Cobden Club, Henry George's Progress and Poverty, J.S. Mill's autobiography, Ruskin's Unto This Last, The Statesman's Yearbook for 1895, and a textbook specially adapted to such and such an examination by the tutors of some correspondence college. What can you expect from such a supply, but a pitiful mental hash? What is the most intelligent of mechanics likely to secure for himself from this bran pie? Serious subjects are not to be read in this wild, disorderly way. But fiction can be. A novel is fairly complete in itself, and in sticking to novels, the public library readers show, I submit, a better literary sense and a finer intellectual feeling than the muddle-headed, review-inspired, pretentious people who blame them. But manifestly the public libraries ought to be equipped for serious reading. Too many of them are covers without meat, or, at least, with nothing to satisfy a respectable mind hunger. And the obvious direct method to equip them is to organize an association, to work, if possible, with the librarians, and get this serious side of the libraries, this vitally important side, into better order. A few men with a little money to spend could do what is wanted for the whole English-speaking world. The first business of such an association would be to get guides to various fields of human interest written, guides that should be clear, explicit bibliographies, putting all the various writers into their relationships one to another, advising what books should be first taken by the beginner in the field, indicating their trend, pointing out the less technical ones and those written obscurely. Differential type might stamp the more or less important works. These guides ought to go to every public library, and I think also that all sorts of people would be eager to buy them if they were known to be comprehensive, intelligent, and inclusive. They might even pay. Then I would suggest this association should make up lists of books, to present an outline course or a full course corresponding to each guide. Where books were already published in a cheap edition, the association would merely negotiate with the publisher for the special supply of a few thousand copies of each. Where books were modern and dear, the association would negotiate with publisher and author for the printing of a special public library edition. They would then distribute these sets of books either freely or at special rates, three or four sets or more to each library. In many cases the association would probably find it preferable to print its editions afresh, with specially written introductions, defining the relationship of each book to the general literature of the subject. Footnote. In America Mr. George Isles is already organizing the general appraisement of books for the public library reader in a most promising manner. The bibliography of the literature of American history, with an appraisal of each book, which has appeared under his direction, is edited by Mr. Larned, and is a most efficient performance. It is to be kept up to date by Mr. P.P. Wells, librarian of the Yale Law School. It includes an appendix by Professor Channing, of Harvard, which is on the lines of the guides I suggest, though scarcely so full as I should like them. This appendix is reprinted separately for 5 cents, and it is almost all English public librarians and libraries need, so far as American history goes. The English Fabian Society, I may note, publishes a sixpenny bibliography of social and economic science, but it is a mere list for local librarians, and of little use to the uninitiated reader. Such an association in the present state of publishing would become, in Great Britain, at any rate, quite inevitably a publishing association. A succession of vigorous, well-endowed voluntary publishing associations is a quite vital necessity in the modern state. A succession is needed, because each age has its unexpected new needs and new methods, and it would not be a bad idea to endow such associations with a winding-up clause that would plump them, stock, unspent capital, and everything except perhaps a pension fund for the older employees, into the funds of some great public library at the end of 30 or 40 years. Several such associations have played, or are still playing a useful part in British affairs, but most of them have lost the elasticity of youth. Lord Brougham's Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge was one of the earliest, and we have today, for example, the Society for the Promotion of Christian Knowledge, the Catholic Truth Society, the Rationalist Press Association, and the Fabian Society. There is a real need today for one, indeed there is room for several publishing associations that would set themselves to put bright modern lights into these too often empty lanterns, the public libraries. So lit Great Britain and America would have in them an instrument of public education unparalleled in the world, infinitely better adapted to the individualistic idiosyncrasy of our peoples than any imitation of German colleges can possibly be. Propaganda of all sorts could be diverted to this purpose. Persons of imperialistic tendencies might well consider the advisability of guides to good geographical and historical reading, and sets of travel books, and of geographical and historical works. Americanizers might consider the possibility of sets that would help the common British to a clearer idea of America, and Americans to a realization that the British Islands are something more than three obscure patches of land entirely covered by a haughty peerage and a slightly absurd, but historically interesting crown. Indeed, whatever you want thought or believed, I would say, give books. But the good new Republican would have a wider scope for his publishing association than to subdue it to this specific doctrine or that. It is not the opinion makes the man. It is not the conclusion makes the book. We live not in the truth, but in the promise of the truth. Sound thinking, clearly and honestly set forth, that is the sole and simple food of human greatness, the real substance and the real wealth of nations. The key that will at last unlock the door to all we can dream of or desire. X. Thought in the modern state, these speculations upon the possibilities and means of raising the average human result have brought us at last to the problem of increasing the amount of original intellectual activity in the state as a culminating necessity. That average child who threads our speculations has been bred and fed, we now suppose, educated in school and college, put under stimulating political and social conditions and brought within reach, and under the influence of the available literature of the time, and he is now emerging into adult responsibility. His individual thought and purpose has to swim in, and become part of the general thought and purpose of the community. If that general flow of thought is meager, his individual life will partake of its limitations. As the general thought rises out of its pools and narrow channels towards a wide flood, so each individual becomes more capable of free movements and spacious cooperations towards the general end. We have bred our citizen and trained him only to waste all his energy at last. He is no better than the water in an isolated dry season pool in the bed of a tropical river, unless he can mingle in the end with the general sea of thought and action. Thought is the life, the spontaneous flexibility of a community. A community that thinks freely and fully throughout its population is capable of a thousand things that are impossible in an unthinking mass of people. The latter, collectively considered, is a large rigid thing, a lifeless thing, that will break rather than bend, that will die rather than develop. Its inevitable end is dust and extinction. Look at the thing from the baser level of political conceptions, and still that floating tide of thought is a necessity. With thought and gathered knowledge, things that mean tumult, bloodshed, undying hatreds, schisms and final disaster to uncivilized races, are accomplished in peace. Constitutional changes, economic reorganizations, boundary modifications and a hundred grave matters. Thought is the solvent that will make a road for men through alpine difficulties that seem now unconquerable, that will dissolve those gigantic rocks of custom and tradition that loom so forbiddingly athwart all our further plans. For 3,000 years and more, the book has been becoming more and more the evident salvation of man. If our present civilization collapses, it will collapse as all previous civilizations have collapsed, not from want of will, but from the want of organization for its will, for the want of that knowledge, that conviction, and that general understanding that would have kept pace with the continually more complicated problems that arose about it. Footnote. Dr. B.D. Crozier, in his most interesting and suggestive history of intellectual development, terms the literary apparatus that holds a people together to a common purpose, the idol of that people, and suggests that the idol of a modern people should be the history of civilization. His work expresses by very different phrases and methods a line of thought closely akin to the thesis of this paper. One writes of present civilization and of previous civilizations, but indeed no civilizations have yet really come into existence. Tribes have aggregated into nations, nations have aggregated into empires, and then, after a struggle, has come a great confusion of thought, a failure to clarify a common purpose, and disintegration. Each successive birth has developed a more abundant body of thought, a more copious literature than the last. Each has profited by the legacy of the previous failure, but none have yet developed enough. Mankind has been struggling to win this step of a permanent civilized state, and has never yet attained any sort of permanency unless perhaps in China. And that sole imperfect permanency was based primarily upon the literature. A literature is the triumphant instrument of the invincible culture of the Jews. Through the whole volume of history, the thoughtful reader cannot but exclaim, again and again, but if they had only understood one another, all this bloodshed, all this crash, disaster, and waste of generations could have been avoided. Our time has come, and we of the European races are making our struggle in our turn. Slavery still fights a guerrilla war in factory and farm. Cruelty and violence peep from every slum. Barbaric habits, rude barbaric ways of thinking, grossness, and stupidity are still all about us. And yet in many ways we seem to have got nearer to the hope of permanent beginnings than any of those previous essays in civilization. Collectively we know a great deal more, and more of us are in touch with the general body of knowledge, than was ever the case at an earlier stage. Assuredly we know enough to hope that we have passed the last of the Dark Ages. But though we hope, we deal with no certainties, and it is upon the broadening and increase of the flow of ideas that our hope depends. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.